This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing Sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Yak! All right, Nooner fans, welcome back. After 5 years in the can, it's time for the Nooner to come back. Raw, unfiltered, unedited, in all its glory. It's me, Bo Edge, and my one of the best friends a man could ever have, Chance Mock. The third best friend that could ever have, John David Lewis, will not be with us on this inaugural tourney. Chance, any guesses as to where John David might be today?
If it was my guess on a beautiful day like today in Austin, Texas, he is probably on the golf course, which is much better than hanging out with you and I.
You're dead wrong. You know what he's doing? He's getting a wig permanently installed on his head so he can come back and be a three-point shooter that the Longhorns desperately need.
Well, he definitely needs it. You know, John David did have a few little highlights.
Yeah, well, for a team that loves to shoot as many threes as this Texas Longhorn basketball team, they actually could use John David. So we'll see if a guy with shaggy hair comes up in the next few weeks with the transfer, we'll know where John David was. If not, he'll join us soon enough.
You know, can we put in a request that he gets long hair with braids like Brecklin Hager?
Well, no, I was hoping he went with the cornrows like Dylan Osakowski did last year at 20.
God, I don't ever want to see that again, to be honest with you.
Well, that's a perfect segue, Mr. Mock. Number five, if Brecklin Hager finds a way to win this game on Saturday, the braids go away. Do you think he goes clean shaven bald head, or do you think he just cuts it short?
Well, I mean, look, for me, I look at him, he wears the number 44, he wears it well. I got to go back to my old man that wore number 49, Aaron Humphrey. I think he just got to go bald. Go all the way. You know, he's already extreme, right? And this is coming from somebody who I do everything to the extreme. Hence the reason I quit drinking a year ago, because I can't just do anything moderately. And I think Brecklin's probably the same way. Brecklin, got to have the long hair. Well, now if you're going to cut it, dude, you got to go bald. We got to pick it.
Just straight razor, just gone, not a hair on the head?
Oh, dude, could you imagine Brecklin Hager coming out with just a straight, bald, shaved head, just looking ready to rock?
I can envision it, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's try to start before we get to the Big 12 title game against just terrible, terrible people up north. I want to hear what your positives and negatives are about the Texas Longhorns as they head into this championship game that not a lot of people would have thought they were going to beat.
Well, look, I never liked ending on a negative note. So let's start with some of the downsides, some of the things that I've seen throughout the year that have upset me so that we can flush those out, we can discuss those, and then move on to the positive things. The first thing that I think has really probably been the biggest sore spot to me is the fact that this team continually plays to the level of their competition. I mean, when they play big games, this team shows up and they're good. They're not an average team. They are a good football team. But when they play a lower level tier team, a la the Maryland game, you know, the Tulsa game, those games, they tend to have a lull and play down to the level of their competition. Now, I don't know where that comes from and how Tom remedies that, but for me, that's been the biggest negative so far.
See, for me, the biggest negative is the lack of on-field time for certain players, guys that you see glimpses of and just wish you had more information as to why they weren't out there more, like a Keontae Ingram. Why? Like, you see the production, you see it. If it's an injury, then tell us it's an injury. And you can be vague and ambiguous or whatever, but tell us what's going on because we see it. You know, and we saw this last year with certain players where guys get preferential treatment. I'm sorry, but I'm the guy that called out guys by name. How are certain guys like PJ Locke, on the field all the time, Anthony Wheeler, when there are guys that are proving it behind them that, let's see what they got. That's the only negative to me this year. I think 9-3 exceeded most expectations, or at least hit the bar You know, some of us did predict 9-3, but I don't think anybody with a rational brain was predicting anything better than that, like a 10-2 or something. So I think they actually hit the target. But moving into next year, what I'd like to see is some of the guys get on the field that have proven they belong on the field.
Well, so I have my thoughts on that changed dramatically about 8 years ago when I was coaching Pee Wee football for the first time. For the first time, I was put in a situation where I was no longer in control of what was happening on the field, and all I could do was go with the players that I trusted. And that, to me, was the hardest adjustment of coaching youth football. I know it's not college, but it's the same premise. And, you know, Coach Brown, Coach Davis used to always preach, we've got to be able to trust you. And it really never hit home until I became a coach, because you have to be able to trust that those kids are going to, young men, are going to do what you're asking them to do. So when I see certain players that make plays but are not getting the playing time that they should, it tells me personally that something's going on behind the scenes, whether that could be something as small as the way that they handle their academics, just showing their maturity, or things that happen in practice. They blow a coverage here or there, or they're blowing coverages more frequently, or they're not making an open field tackles, they're not in position, things like that. That put a doubt in the coach's mind, because at the end of the day, the coach is going to put the guys on the field that he trusts. Does that mean they're going to be perfect? Absolutely not. We all make mistakes. We're all human. But you're seeing these shots of greatness, and it could be something so small as they haven't picked up the defense or the offense yet. They're not comfortable with them. Hey, if we have to check out of a defense into something else, they've showed us they're not quick enough to get into that adjusted coverage. Things like that are probably why you're seeing less playing time.
Okay, so I want to hold that conversation as we move into the game against Oklahoma on Saturday and some changes that they might make with it being the last game of the season. But before that, you said you were going to hold the positives till the end. So I want to hear what you're most positive about what's transpired this year.
Well, I think to me, the way that I look at it is I would have to say our number one positive for me is head and heels above anything else is the receiving crew. We knew they were going to be good. I don't think I had any idea. We knew what they could be, but it's been so long. We've been trained, Bo, over the last really decade. The Texas football sets expectations all summer long. We hear how good these guys are. We hear how great they're going to be. And what did they do? They came out flat against Maryland again. And it was almost like you and I had the conversation that day. And it's like, I'm done. I am so tired of hearing how great they are and how they've made improvements, and they're stronger than they've ever been, and they're faster, and they look better. All this stuff, right? We hear it all the time. You know, the reporting that comes from guys like Ketchum. All of the time we're hearing it. And then what happens? They let us down. But the one position, week in, week out, that I feel like has been really, really good, blocking downfield, making big-time plays, getting open, being able to finish in the end zone, has been the receiving corps.
Well, and you can't disagree with that. The receivers have definitely performed, specifically L.J. Humphrey. I think Colin Johnson still has some room to improve. I think Duvernay finally showed up a little, which is probably more the coordinators allowing him to show up than him doing anything wrong, per se. And I agree with you on the blocking, but as a guy that was not the most vocal advocate for Sam Ellinger, I have to say it's got to be Ellinger. I mean, I nicknamed him Unclutch Tim Tebow after the Maryland game. Well, yeah, he's a great runner, but he never seemed to make, you know, he's got a clunky throw in motion, or so I saw it. And he's good, you know, good running the football. And he's a good inspirational guy. But when the difference between Tebow and Ellinger, in my mind, was that when it was nut cutting time, Tebow always found a way to win. And Ellinger seemed to find a way to lose, going back to his first year, you know, whether it was the USC game or the Oklahoma State game or the Texas Tech game. And then it happened again at Maryland. I was like, you're getting all the intangibles of, you know, you're getting all the on the field stuff of Tim Tebow, but none of the intangibles. And I will be the first one to say I was dead ass wrong. Sam Ellinger can throw a football. And I mean, you may have a different opinion of that as a former UT quarterback, but the leaps and bounds he's made in 1 year throwing the ball and actually throwing the guys in the middle, hitting seam routes, throwing balls up for grabs that aren't, in my opinion, 50-50 balls. When you have Colin Johnson on the sideline and you throw it to a point where he can high point it, he's the only guy getting that football. The game winner against Tech. That wasn't a mistake. He threw it to where only LJ could get it, and no one else. I got to say, with the offensive line being 1B as far as their progression from where they've been, Sam Ellinger's improvement has been the most positive thing of this year.
Well, it's been really good. And this is You know, I go back to something that Zeke Gronkowski, who was one of the great quarterback gurus from long ago, you know, he backed up Bart Starr. That's how old he is. And, you know, he's a great quarterback guy. And he told me, he said, look, the thing is, the quarterback position, you can make every throw. It's not a problem. He goes, but the bigger games are going to require 6 to 8 throws that the average person could, or average quarterback could not make. Normal games, are going to, they're going to take 2 to 4 throws that the average quarterback could not make. And that's what it takes to win. And that's what's impressed me with Sam is as the season's progressed, really not even in the Tulane game, but starting at USC, of making those throws that are harder than average because the outs, you know, the deep balls, those throws everybody can make. I'm talking about 3rd and 12, making a throw on an end cut or a post, doing those kind of things. And it's really funny when you look at, you know, if you throw 35, 40 times a game, that it only comes down to really 6 to 8 throws in a, you know, in a big game that you've got to make. Well, guess what? He's making those throws right now. And that's what's impressive. I mean, look at the loss at Oklahoma State. We started slow and we didn't, you know, we weren't able to close the deal, if you will. But there were some big throws. They fought their way back. They can, you know. And those things have been the continued growth to me. And you know, but again, you look at, I sent you a text in the middle of the game 2 weeks ago against Iowa State. And I told you, I said, Sam has got to understand how important he is to this team. And he's got to understand Shane has done a good job. He's done everything. He's done all the right things that they've asked. He said the right stuff. He's been there. He filled in when he had to. But this team is a different team when Sam Ellinger is not on the field. And he has got to do a better job as he progresses in learning, look, can't you don't need you to dive for an extra 3 yards, to take a head-on hit, to get a hit on your shoulder, to fall awkwardly. Get your yards, get out of bounds, or get down. Play the next down.
I don't disagree with that. Now, let's bridge that into this game that's coming up on Saturday, the Oklahoma game. Because if there ever was a game where you're going to put it on the line, it's going to be this game. Without getting into specifics as to why, who wins the game on Saturday?
You know, first,
not a homer. And like, obviously, we're both going to stick Texas from our heart. We're both going to take Texas as former graduates of the university. Who do you actually think wins on Saturday?
I think, and Texas fans are not going to like to hear this, I think it's just too difficult to beat a team. If Texas would have lost the first game, I'd be picking Texas. But with the fact that Texas won the first game, Oklahoma, they got a high-powered offense. Their defense is pitiful. We're going to be able to score against them. It's just going to be, can we prevent Oklahoma from doing the thing that they did in the second half against West Virginia? And can we prevent them from doing the thing that they did in the second half against Texas? I mean, they erased a large lead against Texas very quickly. And it's going to be one of those games, to me, that I think is not a shootout, but it'll be, you know, if I was putting the over, I'd set it at 75, and I think it's going to be a game of 38-35 type game with Oklahoma on top.
Let me come at you from this angle, though, because you watched the Oklahoma game many times, just like I did, because as good as that outcome was, multiple times, that's the long horn in you. Do you think that the Texas team that jumped out for 3 quarters and had a 21-point lead, do you think Oklahoma coming back was just their offense finally hitting its stride? Do you think that it was bound to happen? It just happened to happen late and not early? Or do you think it's because for a team that hadn't yet got its sea legs and learned how to win and close out football games, that Todd Orlando and that defense dropped into a shell, quit doing what they'd done for 3 quarters, quit trying to force turnovers, and they were literally trying to keep it in front of them? And against that team, that was the wrong call, because then you have plays like Devontae Davis taking an atrocious angle against Kyler Murray, allowing a 70-yard touchdown run that wouldn't have happened if they had stayed in the defense they had been running.
Well, you'll never find anybody that despises prevent-type shell defenses more than I do, because I think, you know, you can even take a microcosm of the big, you know, dance with the one who brung you and put it into one game, and it's the same thing. For 3 quarters, you dominate. You keep pressure up. You have spies. You've got wide receivers covered. You're making those throws harder to make under pressure. And then all of a sudden you drop back and you allow time it doesn't matter. You could put a very average quarterback against a pretty good defense, and they're going to pick you apart. So I have always believed in the pedal to the metal the entire time. And that's one of those things. Now, are there teams that you can come off? Of course. When we used to play the New Mexico States and the Rices, nothing against Rice, but, you know, you pummel them as much as you can in the first half, and then our goal was always to come out in the second half, shove a drive down their throat, put more points on the board, and make them quit. Because you come out of halftime, you've made your adjustments, but then if you come out and you shove it down their throat, at that point you shut out. Against Oklahoma, you can't do that. You just got to go in, you know, quarter to quarter to quarter to quarter, and finish out the game doing what you're doing. Keep the pressure on them. You know, when you take the best quarterbacks in the NFL, when is Tom Brady, what is his lowest percentage of completion is when he's rushed, not hit, when he's rushed, because it makes you uncomfortable. And if you keep that pressure, Murray's going to make mistakes. He will. He's been proven to do so. You know, he's a great quarterback. We give him credit where credit's due, but you can't let off the gas.
Well, and that's why I think Texas actually wins, and not from me being a Longhorn homer perspective. I think Texas has a blueprint in their mind, and they've seen the emergence of a guy like Anthony Cook and B.J. Foster, who, you know, are not freshmen anymore. And I think they are going to attack. And I think Oklahoma, I think it's more likely that Oklahoma and Kyler Murray makes a couple of mistakes than Sam. If we get a game, Sam, I think Texas wins by seven to 10 points. I think I don't think it was a fluke that Texas was up in the fourth quarter of that game. I think they had a better game plan. I think they diagnosed ways to beat Oklahoma. And I think Oklahoma, while they're a juggernaut on offense and the national pundits are already putting them in the title game, Oklahoma has a lot more on the line in going to the college football playoff, where Texas has none of that on the line. And look at all the close games Oklahoma's played. People just make them out to be this world beater. They beat West Virginia by 3, Tech by 5. They got lucky against Oklahoma State, where if Oklahoma State hits a 2-point conversion, that was there, by the way. Like, if Taylor Cornelius throws the out route to where it is, Oklahoma's a 2-loss Oklahoma team and not even in this conversation anymore. So I think Oklahoma is getting drastically overrated in this game as this unbeatable force. I just don't think it is. And I think Texas has no pressure whatsoever. They already won this game once. Now they're playing on house money. I think Texas goes out and plays the best game they've played of the season, where I think Oklahoma doesn't. Now we could talk about this for days.
Well, hold on. I want to point you to one game. If I was the Texas coaching staff, that I would go and look at. And that one game is LSU and Alabama. To me, if Texas comes out and they do exactly the opposite of what LSU did, LSU knew that they had a good defense, but they're matched up. Well, LSU has a great defense, and they're matched up against a great offense. And Enfinger continued to go with this high tempo, up speed offense that put his defense in a vulnerable position. They made stop after stop after stop, but the offense would come in, go 3 and out, burn a minute, and then the defense is back on the field. If I'm Texas, I'm looking at that game and I'm saying, we're going to go in, we're going to control the time of clock, we're going to control possession, and we're going to keep our defense fresh and off the field. And if they do that, I think Texas wins.
Well, the only preface to that would be if Oklahoma, in their adaptation of their new game plan, is designing their defense to stop Ellinger and the running attack, and they start loading the box, they don't have the help. They don't have the safeties right now with the injuries they have and their little bitty cornerback. If they keep walking everybody up and they're putting 8 in the box, it may cost Texas the game, but I would love to see Sam try to exploit over the top, or at least in the middle with the deep digs and the seam routes to LJ Humphrey, to Colin Johnson, get Duvernay involved, because Oklahoma's going to hit big plays against Texas. That I have no doubt about. You can go ahead and write it down. Hollywood Brown is going to have 2 touchdowns and do a little band. He might put the horns down, and hopefully they don't flag it for it, because that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of from the Big 12 saying that. I hope it's just a warning and not real. But I think if Oklahoma gives Texas over the top, they have to try to take it. You can't be silly and run into an 8-man front with a line that isn't that good, because that's how Texas will lose the game. If Oklahoma tries to dictate that, Texas has to punch them back and say, okay, walk 8 up, watch what happens. And then when they get that soft box, then they start hammering them.
No, absolutely. But you can attack that in several ways, as opposed to throwing low completion tight passes, like just deep balls. You can run.
I'm not talking go routes.
You know,
I'm talking about.
Yeah, you can run post corners.
Post,
you can
exactly
run all that stuff. Yeah, and I think we can exploit them there. But that's what I go back to with sustaining drive. It's not run into, you know, run zone into the blitz screen and then try to throw it long. And, you know, you hit 2 out of 10. I mean, if you hit 2 out of 10 deep balls, you're in trouble. But if you're hitting in routes and corner routes and outs, and you're eating up 8, 10, 12, 15 yards a pop, and you're mixing in that run to keep them honest and slow down that pass rush a little bit, which is pretty non-existent, to be honest with you, you're going to be okay, and you're going to have success. And those big balls are going to present themselves. You know, you'll catch a post route where you got one-on-one with one of the small corners, and one of those safeties is out of position, and it hits, and it's a touchdown.
Okay, well, let's move the conversation a little further forward, because this was going to be, you know, a shorter version of Revenge of the Nerds. We're just trying to get our sea legs under us, if you will. So let's go with the assumption that Oklahoma loses to Texas, because I don't want to foresee a scenario where the Pirates from up north do anything other than that. So let's start there. Who, in your opinion, should be the four teams in the playoff after this weekend?
Well,
I mean, you have the obvious ones, Alabama, Clemson. Those two, I think, are guaranteed. And I think Notre Dame you can't dispute it. Well, that would
how
be
do
my
keep
question.
Ohio State out?
If Georgia loses, let's in a very competitive battle against Alabama, let's say that. If Georgia loses 31-28 to Alabama, last drive, Alabama kicks a field goal, and Ohio State goes and beats Northwestern by 4 points because they're not any good, do you allow a two-loss Georgia team to stay where they're at because Ohio State didn't do anything impressive? Or do you think if Oklahoma loses, it's Ohio State no matter what?
Well, I think it has to, number
and
one.
And not from what will happen, what do you, from your eyeballs, who are the 14?
Well, let's play your scenario. Georgia has a hard-fought battle. It comes down to a three-point win. And at the same time, Ohio State only gets a three-point win. I'm putting Georgia in. They've earned it. They've run the gauntlet of a conference that is known for tough football. I'm not saying it's the, you know, it's the world beater conference. I mean, it's got its flaws. Look,
the top end is great in the SEC. The upper echelon of the SEC is better. The lower echelon is just, it's not
it's
that
very,
good. I'm sorry, you can't convince
average.
Me that Kentucky is a great team, or that Florida team is great. They're okay.
Well, Auburn is okay. South Carolina is
Auburn
bad.
Auburn is okay. A&M is okay. And I'm not saying that to disparage Texas A&M. I'm not being anti-Aggie in that regard. Look, the upper crust of the SEC is better than the upper crust of the Big 12, and nobody, I think, would deny that. Alabama and Georgia, as 1 and 2, are better than anything the Big 12 brings to the table, including Oklahoma. Sorry, but that's the reality. Georgia doesn't have 4 wins by less than 7 points against decent teams like Oklahoma. Georgia kicks the crap out of teams that aren't in their class. They lost to LSU one day. They had a bad day. Other than that, they've owned everything.
I think people get obsessed with conferences and they get obsessed with names, right? And that happened. But when I got done playing at Texas, I looked at it and I would argue with people that at that time, the Big 12 was the toughest conference in football. And that was, I truly believe that. And why? Because top to bottom, with the exception of Baylor and Kansas, at that time, Oklahoma State, Kansas State was a top 10, 15 team every year. Texas was great. Oklahoma was great. Texas Tech was putting up top 15 programs. You know, they top to bottom was a tough schedule, whereas at that time, LSU was great. They competed for a national championship. Georgia was good. Auburn played for a national championship, you know, with Cam Newton and those guys. But underneath that, you have a lot of teams that were below average to me. Vanderbilt, terrible. Kentucky, terrible. Tennessee, after they won, you know, when Fulmer left, they're not good. You know, Florida was good at that time. They had the Tebows and that. But other than that, the top 3 or 4 teams in the SEC, it fell off dramatically, whereas the Big 12, I felt, was tougher top to bottom. Those things have changed a little bit, but a lot stays the same from the standpoint of the lower echelon of the Big 12 has fallen off.
But the SEC, the lower echelon, is not as good as they get credit for. People live on, when you go and you play a team like Auburn, you think of the history of Auburn and the Bo Jacksons and those guys, and you go, you know, that's a great team. When you play Nebraska, you think of the Nebraskas of old, and the name is bigger than the team itself. And I think that's one of the things that we get enamored with. But to what I think will happen, I think Ohio State's going to blow the doors off of them. I think in the end, Alabama's going to outlast Georgia, and it's going to end up being a 10-plus point game. And I think you end up with Ohio State in there with Notre Dame and Alabama and Clemson.
If the, just real quickly, if Oklahoma beats Texas, does Oklahoma deserve the spot over Ohio State, no matter what Ohio State does to piddling little Northwestern?
I don't think they do, but I think the national media will give it to them.
Okay, well, let's move forward a little bit. I got to give you a chance. Anybody that listened to us when we were back on the air way back in the day of the original Nooner knows that you're a diehard Houston Texans fan and that I'm a diehard Tennessee Titans fan. So I would be remiss if for at least a minute I didn't give you the soapbox, especially because JD isn't here to play referee. I will sit back and enjoy the tongue lashing I'm about to receive because my team got smoked by yours on Monday Night Football, and it pretty much, you know, locked the Houston Texans in for the divisional title. So tell me how good your Texans are. Are they actually a candidate to make a run to the Super Bowl, or are they just beating up on powder puffs like my Titans?
I think they've got a shot in the AFC. I think when you look at the NFC, it's they're just better right now, you know. And I look at a team like New England. New England is not who they have been in the past. Even the Chargers, they show flashes of greatness. But one thing that the Texans have finally figured out how to do, and this goes back to, well, I am not a Bill O'Brien fan, and I just think he's overrated, and I don't think Bill Parcells had a great saying. He said, great coaches adjust their game plans to fit their team, not the other way around. And I think Billy O has a problem with that, and they've got a real problem in the red zone. Every time they get in the red zone, it's two runs, the play action, the tight end, and we're kicking a field goal. That started to change, but one of the big things that he did is he came out. Deshaun Watson missed 70% of the season last year. I know he did great in the first couple games he played, but then he got hurt. He's still a rookie. You can take a guy like Aaron Rodgers, and you can say, you're going to go one series here.
All right, so you can take it back up, telling me how good the Texans are.
Yeah. But, no, I think where Bill O'Brien made a huge mistake is overestimating the amount of reps and experience that Deshaun Watson had last year. And I think he babied him too much in the preseason. I think he needed to be treated like a rookie. He needed the reps. And those first three games, he was not good. The defense was getting beat. And I think a lot of times, you know, in a comparison to Ellinger, the team believes in Sam and they play hard for him. The same things with Deshaun, the team believed in him. And when he was struggling, the team struggled. He's finally gotten his feet underneath him. And they're a very, very good football team. They're not a great football team, and I don't see them in the Super Bowl. But that being said, if they continue to improve, when you've got a defense that's playing the way that their defense is playing, you've got a shot. Defense wins championships. Everybody knows that. As long as they stay healthy, you know, and you need to get a little more production out of Jadeveon Clowney. I mean, good Lord, the guy gets so many penalties, it drives you nuts. He's got so much talent. Somehow or another, he got a penalty when he wasn't even dressed out this year. I mean, that's impressive. I don't know who figured that out, but he learned how to do that. But that being said,
that's the JD Lewis play.
South is terrible.
If anybody would get a foul on him sitting on the bench, it would have been JD.
I mean, you look at the AFC South, and, you know, your Titans are just not a good football team. They're just not. And, you know, Jacksonville, good Lord. I mean, it's like watching a train wreck. And
if you don't have a quarterback, you can't compete in the NFL. And I swear right now, you could put pads on and do better than what Blake Bortles is doing out there.
Well, I tell you this, Chris Sims, when he was ranked as best quarterbacks, ranked himself, who's not even in the league, above Blake Bortles, if that tells you anything.
And I don't think he was wrong, although he would need a swing to play.
Yeah, but no, so you look, it's an interesting time in the NFL. I don't think I love what they're doing with the Rams. That offense is explosive. The defense plays really well. I just personally,
when you look at the weapons that the Saints have, and Drew Brees is just, he's just awesome to watch. And you add that in with a defense that's actually playing, they're my front runner right now.
Oh, I think it's New Orleans. And I'm sorry, but I think you have to, at least at present, I think New Orleans is the class of the NFC. And I think the Rams are a close second. But I think people haven't discussed enough how losing Cooper Kupp hurts that offense, because that was Goff's 100% safety blanket. And much more than Josh Reynolds is not Cooper Kupp. So I would say that I put the Saints ahead of the Rams until they get beat. And it's just they are who they are, and they can struggle during the regular season or whatever. I'm not betting against the Patriots in the playoffs, especially when it's going to come through their house, until they lose one. Whether it's to the Steelers with Big Ben, or your Texans, or the Chiefs, who I think, the Chiefs are Oklahoma. They can score on anybody, but they can't stop anybody. The problem is they're not playing anybody. The real dark horse, I think, over there is the San Diego Chargers. But at the end of the day, I'll still take the Patriots. So I want to do one more thing before we cut off our initial foray into getting back into this podcasting radio world. I want to give you a couple minutes to tell everybody out there what he, A, meant to you, and B, how much success he'll have at North Carolina. And I'll preface it by saying I was a vocal advocate that it was about time for Mac to go, as he was going down the last couple games of his career. But he's also a good person. Mac was the first person that shook my hand when I got engaged at the 50-yard line of Memorial Stadium. You were there. You may not remember. But y'all were all talking to me when I was a 22-year-old punk. That, a couple of your teammates and my buddies, Bo Trahan and Chad Stevens, that had finagled me a key to get into the after practice on the field one night. But when Mac caught wind of it, as soon as I walked off, he was standing there with you and the rest of the team, and the first person that shook my wife's hand when she said yes was Mac Brown. And so there's always, I still have a framed picture of that in my house. So while I didn't like some of the performance on the field, Mac as a person, I would go, he's amazing. So I wanted to give you, as we send this off, a chance for you to expound a little bit on who Mac is and what kind of success you think he'll have in North Carolina.
Well, first of all, Coach Brown is one of the best people I've ever been around. I think a lot of people think, because he is so good in public, and he is a politician, there's no doubt. I mean, he can walk into a house in Deep East Texas or in the middle of downtown Houston and get along with everybody in the room. That's just how he is. But that doesn't come from a place of falsehood. It comes from a place of relatability, because he genuinely cares. When he talked about family, Matt Minnett, it was something that was serious to him, and he loves the kids that play for him. He loves them, and that translates. He loves his coaches, and, there comes a time in everybody's career where it's just time to move on. It's not even when it doesn't work anymore. It's just you need something fresh, and Mac needed a break. He was tired. I mean, you could see it on his face. You could see it on the sideline. He was tired. He's gotten out. He's gotten a break. And I think everybody kind of thought he always wanted to go back to Carolina. He kept his house in Carolina. He loves the shore there. He likes the university. And I think it's a tremendous step for Carolina. And I think he's going to have a lot of success, because he'll be able to do what you and I know that he does really, really well, and that's recruit. And he's going to be able to get kids there in a conference that he'll be able to win. He'll be able to win the conference. He won 10 win. He had 10 win seasons the last three seasons at Carolina. He'll go back. He'll do it again. I don't know that he makes him a playoff contender, but he definitely turns them around, and he'll win conference championships, and he'll do a good job. And I couldn't be happier for him, because he's born to coach. He's not a micromanager. I tell people all the time, I hope it's not an off on Coach Brown. And if by some chance he ever hears this, I hope he doesn't get mad at me. But I don't think he could have told you a single play we had on offense, because he is under the impression, and it's correct, that if the offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator is doing a poor job, that's on him, because he hired him. And so he hires him for a reason, and he trusts him. Now, does he get on the headset and say, hey, we need to run the ball here? You've got four downs instead of three or whatever. Yes. I mean, he manages the game, but he's meant to lead teams. That's who he is, and he's going to be good.
So, prefacing that, do you think he tries to get the old band back together? You think he hires Gene Chizik as DC? You think he tries to go get Craig Davis back? Or what? Do you think he hires an established, older type staff and leaves the young gun, high-flying stuff to the other schools?
I think he does. Mac is a creature of nature and routine, and he likes that. If you noticed, when things started to unravel at Texas is when you had guys like Greg Davis, who had been with him, moving on. And then you had some issues with Cleve, who I don't want to get into the issues. I wasn't there, and I don't know, but I do know that Cleve is Mac's right-hand man. For lack of a better term, he's his comfort blanket. He always had his back, and he was phenomenal at that. It wouldn't shock me to see him back around the picture either, although he's got a pretty good gig right now. And that's how Mac is. He's got the guys. Goes back to what we talked about, trusting your players. He's got the guys he trusts, and I think he'll bring them back.
So you can foresee a staff that had Akina and Chizik and Davis and
others. Wouldn't shock me in the least.
Is there any?
Nope, wouldn't shock me.
And you can say this. You can say no to this question when I ask it, and we can end the show on that. Is there any coach that you think will not be getting a call to be on that staff? like one that's sitting in College Station right now, running his mouth like he's a true Aggie or something.
Yeah, no, he probably will not get a call.
I'm Coach Bree, are you going to get a shout out?
He recruited me. I could tell someday on this, we'll tell funny stories about Coach Bree. I could go on for an hour.
Oh, there's a bunch of them that you told me in private, and a couple that you told in public, including when he convinced Chris Sims why he should be number one.
Oh, it was number eight.
Just what like he's been promised number one.
Troy Aikman.
Yeah. Forgetting the fact that his dad played for the Giants.
Oh, yeah. Just like your boy, Troy Aikman.
We'll segue that into the next edition of Revenge of the Nooner. Hope everybody enjoyed it. Hit us up on Twitter if you want to give us some notes, if you want to say you liked it, say you didn't like it. I'm at Boedge, BEAUEDGE. And what's your Twitter handle there, big boy?
At Chance Mock.
See, it's easy to find. All right, until next week, this is Revenge of the Nooner.